Alright, Pirate Cat listeners, welcome back to another Techno for Science. This is DJ Rooch, broadcasting from the beautiful Mission District of San Francisco, 21st and Florida. Stop by, get some delicious coffee drinks, or shoot me a call, 415-341-1199. Have some very special guests on Techno for Science this week. Shermeo, global anthropologists, paleontologists, sociologists, and farters. They were discussing farting across the globe. You can check out their blog at shermeo.blogspot.com. All right, let's get back to the music. Stay tuned for the interview. We'll be right back. All right, that was Swayzak with Blue Farm. Classic track from the WNUR days. Speaking of WNUR, my guest this week, friends from Northwestern, two of my dearest friends in the world, Gabe and Amy, also known as Tremeo. Gabe and Amy Tremeo have been traveling the world the last year, having living a fascinating existence, exploring, absorbing. Maybe you guys can tell us a little bit about the overview. Hello, Gabe.
Yeah, sure. Hey. So we started in February, and we started out from New York. And
oh, we need to go farther back. Why? Tell me why.
Why?
Why did you do this? How did you do this?
Well, we're getting older, and I just turned 33. Amy is 31, and it's one of these things where we're still on this point where we had no real obligations, financial or otherwise, to really anything. So that situation is probably going to change in the next year or so if we decide to have kids and, you know, just growing up and starting to settle down and have roots somewhere. But we don't right now. So this was just a really nice opportunity to get out there and travel. Like, to just really see what's going on and see what's up with everybody. So we got it in our head a couple years ago to do this. And for the last, maybe probably like 16 months before we set off for our travel, we did a pretty strict spending plan to save money to do this. And when we were almost ready to hit our goal,
We both got laid off from our jobs.
Got laid off, like,
wonderful.
Which,
like,
was awesome.
Like, was about the most amazing thing that could happen, because it gave an excuse to leave our jobs in a amicable way. We got unemployment and we got severance. So we got the money that we needed like 3 months early. Basically.
Awesome.
So we just left.
and so what was the goal? How did you set this up? You had what seems like a long time. So did you want to spend a minimum amount of time in each place to really kind of absorb the culture? Was there time limits versus time minimums?
There was definitely areas that wanted to be more immersive than others. One of them being Colombia, because that's where the majority of my family that I know is from there. And having grown up as a first-generation kid, I really wasn't that familiar with my family over there. So we really wanted to do that. And then there are certain places that we know we couldn't spend a lot of time. Egypt was one of them, and that actually turned out to be good that we were only 2 weeks in Egypt, because that was probably one of the worst experiences as far as like interacting with people. And then we wanted to spend a huge chunk of time in India, you know, because that's one of the craziest places on this planet.
Some of it was just guesswork.
Yeah, some of it was pure. And also, it was closely aligned, like, with the equator, because we didn't want to go anyplace cold.
Yeah.
There's good logistical reasons for that. Not only, you know, not just because, you know, being cold sucks,
but gear.
Yeah, gear. It's just so much easier to pack warm winter clothes. Yeah. You can wear the same things, and it's just not as challenging. You know, you can have like a really, you can stay in like a really super cheap hostel with paper thin walls, and it's fine because you're not freezing.
Awesome. So you started in Colombia.
Yeah.
Family. Farm.
Ranch. Yeah.
How far away from police stations, hospitals?
I mean,
actually know.
I don't know if there's actually a police station or a hospital. We didn't see
what happens
one.
If you break your leg on a ranch in Colombia?
It's a good question.
We try really hard not to get thrown by a horse.
No one has ever broken
it. No one. Yeah, that's never happened. The ranch was probably about 3 kilometers from a town, the nearest town. But the nearest town was a town, like a town, maybe 100 people. The nearest hospital was probably about 2 hours north, probably.
Probably say. The only a hospital where you would want to go, mm-hmm. yeah. 2 to 3 hours away.
Mm. Yeah.
So you guys were telling me briefly, Colombia was quite different than your expectations.
Yeah, you get. I think the majority of the exposure that comes in the U.S. is from, if you're, I mean, especially on the East Coast, it's a lot of the Caribbean. So it's like Dominicans, Puerto Ricans, that sort of thing. And then from Texas through to California, it's Mexico and Central America. Uh-huh. Maybe a little bit of South America. But Colombia is just in this really weird place where it has this tremendous, black market that we're all familiar with their products. The culture is largely derivative of American pop culture. Like American pop culture is like kind of like the standard, and then everything is kind of derived from that. And it seems pretty hollow. It's like reaching for this thing that is not necessarily Colombian or Latin American, and that kind of replaces the values of maybe what people should be focusing on, like some American set of values, rather than people trying to look inward and trying to fix the problems that they have, you know.
Do you think that was rural based, or is that even in the cities in Colombia? That
no. It's just... I think it's primarily in the cities. Oh, I think in the city. Yeah, I think in the cities, yeah. the aspirational culture tends to mimic American culture.
Yeah.
In terms of restaurants and music and
fashion.
Uh-huh. All of that tends to look at what is going on in LA or in New York or Miami. But if you go into the different cities, the cities do take in a lot of flavor from their immigrants, which is, again, well, I guess very similar to the U.S. Like along the coast, there's a lot of like a West African vibe.
Yeah, and the music reflects that. The music and the style of dance reflects that stuff, which is fascinating. It's really cool.
But what about the food? I feel like food is such an indication of what is unique and how cultures evolve and what makes a city a city. Did you feel like the food was also derivative, or the food? I mean, food is based on what's around you.
Yeah.
And so that obviously creates something unique for any different village, culture, city.
I think if you go into someplace a little bit more expensive, it tends to, again, for somebody who is trying to put a lot of thought into designing a store or designing a restaurant, it tends to look like a store or a restaurant in any international city. We were actually feeling really homesick at the very beginning of our trip, like 2 weeks into it. We were in Bogota, and we were invited out to a birthday party in kind of a trendy neighborhood. Went out, and it looked exactly like a bar in Williamsburg. It was striped wallpaper with a mounted deer head on the wall, and they were playing The Killers. And we were like, huh. It's like we're back
left.
Home.
It's like we never left.
Which at the moment was very comforting, and in hindsight is actually pretty sad.
Uh-huh. You guys were doing, trying to for a while. I don't remember. I haven't kept up recently, but with your blog and chronicling, not just kind of a daily diary, but things that were salient. What did you feel were salient from Colombia? What did you think that moved you to write long pieces in your blog from that time?
That's a good question.
Probably being on the finca.
Yeah, the being in the ranch was probably, because it was like my uncle had done a really interesting thing in the ranch, and that was he made kind of like this living museum of my family. It contains a lot of stuff from different family members that have passed away, and it's this really, really fascinating place that I was able to see, you know, books that my grandfather used to read. I saw a self-portrait that my dad drew when he was 19 years old.
Oh, wow.
Just things like that were really, it was like not only a process of self-discovery of like, these are my roots, but just the rural Colombian culture too, that I think that the city still has nostalgia for, because there is, if you go and look at the one of the most famous steakhouses in Colombia, because the diet revolves around meat, specifically the pig, the chicken, and the cow. I mean, there's no...
Because they taste the best.
Yeah, because they're the most delicious. There is that nostalgia, because the most famous steakhouse in probably in Colombia is kind of like this throwback to a traditional steakhouse, like the traditional restaurant that's like this wooden table of carved meat that is cooked many different ways. And it's like that taken to the extreme in like a very Disneyland, you know, kind of way, but in a really fun Colombian way. Yeah. I mean, it's actually really fun. It's blaring salsa music. It's this liquor, aguardiente, which is like this anise flavored rum that is really,
it's potent,
horrible,
and it hurts
and it really hurts your brain, flowing everywhere, and it's a ton of fun. It's so you can see that like nostalgia for the for that rural culture, which we were experiencing with my uncle. So it was that. It was like these two parts. It was like the family thing and just this beautiful rural culture that is getting mashed out in the cities for that aspirational culture that Amy was talking about.
I think also on a personal level, aside from family history, which was really pretty wild and fascinating, and you know, you spend any amount of time, I think especially as an immigrant kid, in your parents' home country, and you're just going to learn things that you never would have thought or never would have expected.
Yeah.
But
and for some reason, they all want to tell you these
they
things.
They cannot wait to tell you all, pull all the skeletons out of the closet.
Yeah.
But awesome. Being on the ranch, you know, it's going back in time 200 years. They just got electricity, you know, 7 years ago or 8 years ago.
Yeah. There was never a telephone to the ranch, so you needed, but they put up a cell tower about 2 or 3 years ago,
which has been bombed by, you know, the FARC several times. So, you know, communications go out, but for us, you know, they're ranchers. So they kill their own meat. They raise their own chickens. They grow, they buy a lot of their vegetables in town from other people that grow their own produce. But I think we've always been very interested in food and talked big game about, you know, wanting to participate in how our food was grown and slaughtered and treated. And then you actually get into it and it is dirty, nasty business.
Yeah.
And there's some stuff that you just don't want to see and that will always change you.
You know, I find that fascinating that there's a very, you know, the foodie hipster culture in many urban cities is that, you know, the everything local, everything within X amount of miles created, grown and produced from you and farm raised, all fair trade, everything. But then that involves killing things.
It involves killing things. And the idea that if you're going to use every piece of an animal, then you're looking at an animal and you're like, oh, so I guess tomorrow I'm eating unsavory part of this animal.
Not just the breast or the thigh.
But does it make you appreciate it more?
Yes.
Or is that,
Yes, definitely. That was a huge thing. It gave me a lot more respect for
food.
Yeah, for food and where it comes from. And it's like, it's something that it would be cool if more people could participate in that. Then you would really, I mean, because talking about it is a great idea, but when you actually experience it, it's pretty wild. It's really questions your love, because I love to eat meat, but it really questions your commitment to it when you actually have to kill something.
So where to from Colombia?
After that, we hopped on, not a direct flight, because that would be ridiculous to try and get from Bogota to Colombia to Tunisia. We had a layover in New York, and then we took a red eye to Frankfurt, Germany, and then took another red eye to Tunisia, where we spent 3 weeks in Tunisia. And the draw for Tunisia was a couple things. It's on the Sahara, it borders the Sahara, and it really is like a crossroads of North Africa. That's where Hannibal is from. Carthage.
Mm-hmm.
Carthage was located about, I don't know, a 15-minute like commuter train ride from Tunis, the capital. So you have this beautiful history of the Romans coming through, building their, they used Tunisia as like kind of like a bread basket, and they planted a lot of wheat and olives there to feed the empire. Of course, Hannibal came from there. He never spent a lot of time there, actually. He spent all his time harassing the Romans in his famous cross. The Romans were there. Then, you know, after the fall of the Roman Empire, the Arab armies, the armies of Muhammad swept through. And so you have these remnants of all these great civilizations. And then plus you have the indigenous people that were there to begin with. Especially when you get closer towards the desert, you have the Berbers, and they have their culturally their own people. You know, they have their own food, they have their own customs,
mm-hmm. their own languages,
their own language, mm-hmm. And it's, you know, a blatant ripoff in Star Wars because that's where a lot of the desert scenes were shot in the first Star Wars.
Like George Lucas did no costume designing. Everything is lifted from a Berber market.
Oh, yeah, goodness.
Every single thing. Yeah. Yes.
It was the set of Star Wars.
The reason how we found this out was really fascinating. We just happened to be lucky. There's a traveling bazaar that goes through southern Tunisia, and it's traders. You know, it's like they've been doing for the last 1,000 years, running around, except they're not using camels, they're using cars now, but it's still the same basic principle of a bunch of merchants traveling from town to town trading. Awesome. And that happened to be, it literally is a border town in the Sahara, because it's just like a border town in the ocean. You know, it's this town where people embark from and to go into the Sahara. And we caught the local bazaar on a Friday morning. And of course it's like really early in the morning, because once the sun comes out, you can't do anything.
So everything is open from say 5 to 9:30 or 10, and then shuts down again until 4 p.m.
Four or five. But mm-hmm. if you walk around the streets at like 9 o'clock at night when it's dark, I mean, everything is booming. Like the shops are open. People are sewing and trading and eating and just bustling around. It's nice and cool outside. When we were walking through the local bazaar, we saw, you know, a Jedi Knight outfit, and it was a Berber cloak. You know, it's not
awesome.
It's a straight lift. You know.
Yeah. All of like Luke Skywalker's the house at like underground cave.
Yeah.
And basically everything that's on that planet, it's all just Berber style hovels, because it's cooler in there, so people live in them.
They make these underground tunnels and these underground homes, and he just took one that was already there.
Yeah.
Put a couple cardboard set pieces, and there you go. That's the home of Luke Skywalker.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Amy, you're a journalist. Your training is to just get info from people. Did you find that everywhere you went was everybody wants to tell their story? Or were there places where people were more reserved and were scared of Americans, et cetera?
I think people tended to be a bit more reserved in the Arab countries. Partially, you know, maybe that's because I'm a woman. Maybe that's because we're very clearly American, and that's something that we didn't realize would be so glaringly obvious all the time. But as a mixed race couple, there aren't any elsewhere in the world except for in the U.S. Maybe in parts of Europe, but for the most part, everybody knew immediately that we were American. But I think that the toughest place to actually talk to people was in Lebanon, and Lebanon and Egypt were really challenging. Egypt is very hard to speak to locals because the culture there, the treatment of tourists in general, is very aggressive.
Uh-huh.
For myriad reasons, but we never got close to having a real conversation.
No. In Egypt.
No. In Egypt.
No. And in Tunis, or well, all of Tunisia, it was tough because that was one of the places that it was a French colony for a while. For a long time, when the French controlled that whole, like, Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia, that was whole part of the part and parcel of that.
But Tunisians were very friendly. There were language barriers, but, you know, you can always play charades. We have enough Spanish to make their Italian and French for us to be able to communicate.
But the Tunisians were very warm, very, like, that traditional Bedouin hospital, that famous Bedouin hospitality was definitely there.
I think that's traditional Arab hospitality in general.
Yeah, I mean, but the Arabs derive, the Arabness seems to be wrapped up in the Bedouins.
Right.
Like they are like the vanguard of Arabness.
Right. Desert culture in general, it's just such harsh living that nobody would ever begrudge you. It would be against their own moral code to not lend help, whether it's something simple as giving directions or offering a glass of water or tea, and it would be rude not to accept it, which is also something that, you know, as an American, you kind of have to let go of it when you're traveling, because in us, it's always like, oh, no, I can figure it out on my own. Don't worry about it.
Right.
But to a lot of cultures, you're shunning them unnecessarily.
Yeah.
But Egypt is like the one exception.
So Egypt seems like to be standing out from a lot of places for a number of reasons. What was there political weight associated with traveling? Was there mixed race issues? Was there just American issues?
I think it was a lot of it was Western and then American, because Egypt is in it's just a basket case right now. They are a victim, I think, of a really bad guy that's running the place. It's so corrupt. I really think that puts a lot of downward pressure on the country. People are very angry and upset about the state of the government. And they also, it's that internal struggle that they have. But they also, Egypt shares a border with Israel. And Israel is, you know, from what I've read and experienced, it is like the number one beef that the Arab world has. You know,
that's not a question.
It's not a question.
But I think that, you know, the U.S. has, you know, its tenuous relationship with Egypt, because Egypt is its one ally, and then Egypt is alternately resentful of that and requires American aid.
Very significant amount.
Yeah, I mean, I can't remember the numbers, but shockingly large amounts of our foreign aid budget goes directly into Egypt, because we need Egypt.
You need to stabilize Israel's neighbors.
Right.
It's just...
And so then, like, Egypt gets a lot of heat from the other Arab countries, and then there's a lot more resentment that builds up against the West for that. And it's also just culturally the most conservative place we were.
Yeah. Egypt was by far.
Absolutely. Yes. There, I mean, the radicalism in Egypt is stronger than anywhere else where we have been.
Yeah.
I mean, granted, we were not in... We conscientiously did not travel in other parts of the Middle East that weren't as safe. But, I mean, at this point, we've now spent a significant amount of time in Israel a couple years ago, Jordan, Lebanon, and Egypt. And North Africa has a similar, just because it's not the Middle East, but
it has
a strong Arab influence, and it's Muslim. But Egypt is far and away the most challenging place to be. And it's scary. You know, you walk down the street in Cairo and you see a woman getting beaten. And what do you do?
You saw a woman getting beaten.
Actually didn't.
When we were in a hostel,
a guy walked in who was just like stunned. He's like, what do you do? And we were thinking about it. We're like, and you know, of course my reaction is like, you stop it. You do something.
Yeah.
You get in there. And it's like, well,
you take a step back and think about all the things that could happen from you getting involved in that.
And it doesn't necessarily help the woman. You don't know who it is that's beating her. Is it her husband? Is it her brother? Is it her father? Is it a shopkeeper? Is it just somebody on the street?
Yeah.
Do you get arrested and thrown into a prison in Cairo? What happens?
I mean,
there were questions like that that were raised a lot in Egypt that we had a hard time with.
Yeah, it was very, very challenging. I mean, Cairo itself is a trip. Like, it is a really intense megalopolis. I mean, it is a enormous, sprawling, aggressive city. And this is coming from living in New York.
Yeah.
I mean, New York is nothing.
New York is
very
tame compared to Cairo.
Like, on certain busy street corners, some major intersections in Cairo, they actually have gates that they open and close to let people cross the street at a certain time.
Otherwise, cars don't stop.
No. They'll just run over.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, I don't know if they'll run over. We didn't see anybody get run over, but like, they don't stop. Cars just don't stop.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's really, it's, I mean, it's very, very, very interesting. I mean, there's things like that in India too, but yeah, Egypt stood out, and we were only there for 2 weeks, and
we actually cut it short. We were supposed to be there for longer,
yeah.
And we hightailed it out as soon as we possibly could after kind of knocking out the big sites so that we could get to Jordan faster.
Yeah.
And I mean, we're both people that like love, we love traveling in the Middle East, and just Egypt was just too much.
Wow. So when you see stuff like that, when you experience something like that about whatever it is, religion, society, culture, that really creates some of the worst in humanity, maybe. But that's a bold, that's a very judgmental statement, but something that at least for Americans was a little bit more oppressive. Do you see more similarities in people or more differences? And I know I've asked you this about kind of just in general, but like, yeah, when you see the best, the worst relative to your own American perspective, do you think people are more the same? Do you think they want the same things? Or that was such a fundamentally different value system that do you think that they actually wanted different things out of life than you?
I think they're more similar. Yeah. And I wouldn't say that when we were there and we're having a tough time dealing with people or the aggression there, that they necessarily wanted different things. I mean, any person that was up in our face demanding money out of us probably had kids and a family.
Yeah.
You know, and you're shaped by your world and what you read in the papers and what you're living on any day-to-day basis. And if you have a lot of frustration directed towards any one person, you see somebody walking down the street and, you know.
And I think it's exacerbated by the fact that, like, the countries, like we said before, like, there's no, in other countries, it's, you're, especially in Egypt, you're Egyptian, and it's very easy to spot somebody who's not Egyptian.
Yeah.
You know, and it's, and these countries are so homogeneous. Most countries in the world are. Like, America is really an exception to that rule. You know, I mean, and then you take the extreme, like in on the coasts, you know, New York and LA, San Francisco, like people are all mixed up. You know, you can see, but generally when we walked around in these countries, I mean, you don't see anybody else from any other. It's all very clear.
Well, there's the ghettos. I mean, it's, there isn't a mixing up. I think that there is immigration one place to another. But you'll see, you know, there's always going to be a Chinese community somewhere. There's always going to be an Indian, yeah, community somewhere. There's always going to be a Nigerian community somewhere. Uh-huh. That exists. But they're very distinct from each other. Yeah, actually, and I don't think that there was really... Why was I thinking this? Did you mention something about anti-American?
No.
No. Okay. Never mind.
Where did you feel any anti-Americanism? Did you feel anti-Americanism?
Lebanon.
There's this.
Lebanon, yeah, is palpable.
Not in Egypt. It was just tourists were the only way to make money. So everybody, yeah, feels that from.
Yeah, everybody, yeah, that we talked to.
Everybody, you know, and we hung out with like younger Egyptian kids that weren't tourists. Like we'd see them. We were on the Sinai Peninsula for a while, and we hung out with this group of guys, and they were great. And they were also like, oh, God, you know, when they do touristy stuff, it's really frustrating for them because they're like, these guys give Egyptians a bad name. But it was never anti-American. The only place, mm-hmm, where we felt any sort of anti-Americanism was in Lebanon.
Mm. Very, very.
And helpful. That, I mean, we chose to go there because, well, it's, I mean, you could argue how safe it is to travel in Lebanon. But
right. You felt that because people would confront you about American politics or... It was just body language.
Everything.
No, what we did in Lebanon was I had a colleague that I used to work with. She's from Beirut. And we were lucky enough to go to have and stay with her family and have a meal together. And it was wonderful. And what was really interesting about this was that these people were educated. These people were they were well-traveled. Her parents went to India in the 60s, I believe. When
they have a great story about how they tried to make a hotel reservation and you had to write a letter.
Yeah, you wrote a letter, wow, to the hotel. And then you got a letter back.
And then you got a letter
confirming
back.
Confirming your reservation.
I'm not sure I understand what that means.
Right, right. And then they showed up and, of course, they had no reservation.
It's India. It's fine.
Which is totally fine. But it was, we had some really interesting discussions about what... because I mean, Lebanon is really is still bearing, you know, significant. Lebanon and Jordan are still bearing a significant brunt of the creation of Israel. Like, it's still a very contentious political and economic event that's been, you know, that's happened. I mean, they have a ton of Palestinian refugees that have flooded into the country. And the democracy, if you want to call it that, has been destabilized anyway, but you throw in a couple million Palestinian refugees, and then Hezbollah being funded via Syria, via Iran, like, it's a very tense place. And
this family that we met was especially interesting for us because it was the first time I think either of us had ever had a conversation with somebody, with several people who were, we truly believe not anti-Semitic, and they were truly against the state of Israel.
Yeah.
And from where we come from, I think, you know, partially just from being Americans, partially from, like, at least for me, where I grew up in a big Jewish community, like, I could never see a way in which both of those things were possible.
Mm-hmm.
And so having this conversation with these, with this family in Beirut, we're very calmly talking about why Israel had, you know, destabilized the entire region. It was fascinating. Yeah, that Israel did not need to exist.
Yeah.
And I have not resolved, you know, my thinking on that at all. And obviously it's huge, giant, ponderous questions. But it was just, we had never met anybody that we did not, or for me, I'd never met anybody that was, I did not feel like a raving racist lunatic talk about why the state of Israel was a negative for the region until meeting these people. So that was fascinating.
So we have this conversation and we're in this mindset and we're thinking about a lot of things, asking a lot of big questions. And then my friend mentions, like, do you want to go see a Palestinian refugee camp? And that's when she took us. And that was really
the most terrifying.
Yeah, it was very scary.
Hour of our
very,
life.
Like, but it was so, I mean, this,
where
this,
was it?
In Beirut.
There's camps all over Beirut.
Mainly
and
in the south.
Yeah.
Southern part of the city.
They look like, you know, slums anywhere. But what the challenge is that, like, the refugees are treated like animals by the government, by all the surrounding governments. And again, Lebanon has the brunt of the refugees, I think. But, they're not allowed to attend Lebanese schooling. So they have to create, you know, limited schooling within the camps. Palestinian children are not allowed to go into Lebanese public schools. So no schools, no jobs. That's what I meant to say. They can't get legal jobs.
No.
So there's a lot. So there's a lot of, like, cash and labor type work. And so there's still a lot of arms trading.
The camps are not on the power grid.
So they have to steal utilities if they want any sort of, like, water, sewage. Electricity. Sewage is a huge one.
Anything.
Garbage collection.
Yeah.
So how surprising is it that it's the, most of the camp economy is still arms trading, and you see the Hezbollah flags flying high?
Because Hezbollah offers an alternative. That's
so crazy. In America, we're so
build.
Hyper civil rights sensitive. I mean, to the point where, I mean, the tiniest thing just becomes a civil rights issue, and it's all over the liberal blogosphere and blah, blah, blah. And is there any hints of that in Lebanon and some Middle Eastern countries? Are there rumblings about how people get treated and these are actually people and not animals? And is there anything that...
No, because nobody else in the Middle East wants the refugees either.
Yeah.
It's this humongous.
So they'll go
strain.
Where they can. That's it.
I don't think that the countries and the economies are developed enough to even, like, start to do that, because all these countries are still. I mean, maybe Jordan is probably the closest thing, but I mean, these countries have a lot of work to do just to stabilize their own economies, and all of a sudden you bring in a couple million refugees. It's a economic hardship. I mean,
but what's stunning is that, you know, a 5-minute cab ride away from a refugee camp and you are in downtown Beirut, which has been entirely rebuilt since the end of the war, and it's like the World Cup was going on while we were there, and we tried to go to a cafe to watch a game. You know, they'd set up, there's all these big open streetscapes, and they'd set up TV screens and outdoor seating. It is $50 US minimum just to sit down. And there are,
holy crap,
there's no shortage of wealthy Lebanese that can do that, yeah, that live in a universe completely apart.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's very close, and it's, yeah, it's light years away.
That's amazing. Yeah. Well, we definitely want to talk about India before, yeah, we leave today. Well, let's talk about India. Well, did you see anything interesting? So, did you see anything?
So after leaving
different?
The
middle, there's
your segue. Yeah.
Chai. Would
so
you like some chai?
After the Middle East, yeah, we flew, we went Amman to, and we flew into Delhi, and I think at this point it was we kind of joke about it, but it was kind of true. We were finally ready to backpack in India for 2 months, because that is something that you can mentally prepare yourself for, but unless you have experienced anything close to that, it's really not, you really aren't prepared. But we had finally, we'd been around livestock in my uncle's ranch in Colombia. So yeah, you get that familiarity. I mean, if you don't grow up with farm animals around, especially like cows and things, like it's very unfamiliar, right? And it's very, and just the,
bless you.
Yeah, and then you go to you start getting, you know, getting used to touts, you know, that hound tourists, so you get used to that. So let's walk through our first night in Delhi just to like set the stage for what we thought. So we get into Delhi late at night, and we take a cab.
Well, actually, if you want to start with our arrival to Delhi in Jordan, we got onto a plane.
Right, even the,
with,
okay, right.
You know, we had our tickets, and we're in the waiting room with, I don't know, 200 other Indians,
yeah,
and a couple of travelers, mostly other backpackers. So back in coach, it's like us, a bunch of Israelis that are going backpacking, and a bunch of Indian men.
Yeah.
And you have to fill out all the immigration forms. So we're sitting down, and well, we walk back into the plane, and there is a man that we think is working. And he asks Gabe, like, "Oh, you know, what seat are you in?" He's like, "Oh, I can, you know, I found my seat." And he's like, "Oh, okay, if you need help." And we're like, "Okay." And he's like, "Does he work there?" Like, he's not wearing any sort of, you know, Royal Jordanian uniform. And no, he was just directing traffic, because most of the people on the plane could not read their ticket.
Wow.
And then as the immigration forms come out, you know, there's this huge clamor of, like, who's going to do what? Like, everybody, like, people are asking other people to write their forms out for them, because they can't read or write.
Right. Well,
they can't read or write in the Hindi. two yeah, options, which were English and Hindi.
Which, I mean, but I think, yeah, getting on the plane was just,
I mean, even that was an experience
was,
unto
yeah,
itself.
Getting on the plane to go to India was phenomenal, because it was, we sit down, and we sit down before all the Indians get on, and then all of a sudden it's this mad rush, because they're used to, you know, just grabbing a seat, like, you want to grab a seat, and because that's how everything is, like, you just, this fight,
take what you can get
to, yeah, get anything, yeah. So I'm not even sure if they understood that there's no way that they understood there was assigned seats, because they were just grabbing wherever they could, and this man was finally just, yeah, directing traffic and being like, "No, sit there. You know, it was really intense. But the immigration forms was interesting, because we were sitting across from a family, like, clearly a middle class family, that was dressed nice, had two kids. They had all the trappings of, you know, they had nice luggage and all that stuff, and they were bothering the couple to fill out, because they knew, you know, that these people probably knew how to read and write. So they would just bother the couple. So it was, yeah, that was really, really fascinating.
That's amazing. Mm-hmm. Tell me about Varanasi. Crazy things.
Yeah. So, we get into Varanasi for the train.
Oh, God, Varanasi.
And it was we're there during monsoon season. And Varanasi has a lot of, we're in the old part, so there is, the streets are very narrow enough so that if a cow is in front of you, you cannot pass. And that
there's a lot of pushing cows out of your way in order to walk
to
down
push
the street.
The cows out of the way.
Amazing.
Yeah. But the thing is, when it rains, it turns the feces that's on the ground into rivers that flow throughout the city, because there's not a level part in the city. Like, there's the water, so the water's flowing everywhere, and it really
the rivers of poo.
Yeah,
just
the rivers of poo.
That
were on the ground, mixing with the flaking, burning bodies.
In the air. So there's poo on the ground and bodies in the air.
It's a really intense experience. And then there's bodies passing by you because of the funeral processions that are going to the burning ghats.
So why don't you explain why Varanasi is important?
Please.
Varanasi is, it's the holiest city in Hinduism?
No.
Is that right?
It's one of them.
One of the most holy cities. And it's along the Ganges. And it is very, 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 lucky.
Not auspicious.
Auspicious to die in Varanasi. So a lot of, if you're wealthy enough, a lot of people travel to Varanasi so that they can die there. And then your body is cremated along the Ganges, and you are, kind of doused with water to cleanse your body of the sins so you can, move on.
No, you can. It breaks the cycle of reincarnation. Mm-hmm. Like, you go to heaven.
I guess you don't move on. You just stop.
You stop.
Then,
stop.
Which is
that's
the goal.
That's the goal.
So there is death is both very spiritual and important there, but it's also a huge business. So there is actually a caste, which I believe used to be tribal. They're now considered
the firemen caste.
There are groups of people there who handle the bodies, prepare them for cremation, and then actually manage the fires. And there are two ghats, which are basically entryways down into the river that are places for burning bodies. But what you'll have is they burn 24 hours a day, every single day of the year. What you'll have is the priests and the people who are tending to the bodies will come running through the city with bodies on pallets, wrapped in silk, chanting, racing their way down to the ghats.
Oh my God.
So I think we actually had just gotten in, had our backpacks on, were kind of freaking out about picking through the river of poo to get to our hostel, and there was a lot of noise and bells behind us. We flatten ourselves against the wall, and there goes our first body.
Oh my God.
And that was kind of our opening to Varanasi.
Yeah, Varanasi in my mind I thought was like India. Is so there's colors everywhere. It's loud. There's
holy.
It's whole sacred.
It's actually beautiful. We joke about the, the filth, which is nothing.
Which is everywhere.
No small thing.
But yeah, it is very beautiful, and it's just in my mind that was in my mind's eye what India was. Uh-huh. It's this beautiful, holy, sacred, filthy, loud, colorful, super intense place. Especially at night, it is frightening. I mean, because you see the burning bodies, you see the flakes, you're stepping in poo, you hear the animal sounds, you hear all the noise, but you can't see anything.
Oh my God.
Because there's not a lot, because the old city doesn't have lights. There's not a system of lights.
Right.
So you just, and it's just one of these things that, especially for a Westerner where there's such a division, like there's a church on the corner and that's where you go pray. That's where God is. God isn't outside that. Some people have it, some people don't, but India is everything is love. Everything is spiritual. Everything is God. And there's so many different ways. It's just so intense. So it's
awesome.
It's awesome, but it's frightening.
Well, I'm so sorry. I have to cut this short. We are done for today. But you guys are off to China and then Korea, and I hope you guys can come back, and we'll talk about that when you come back to the States.
Most deaf.
Sounds good.
Real quick, most racist people in the world.
Indians.
Word. Thanks to Gabe and Amy. This has been Techno for Science. See you next week.
Hey, Hey there, pirate cat-cateers. This is Howard Stone from This Is the Week That Is, with what's going on at Pirate Cat Radio, the last week in December, the last week of the year. We'll be back on Sunday with the Balkan Vulcan Show from 1 to 3, where BDOG from Macedonia will be available. And at Sanguine Soul from 3 to 5, we'll have DJ Alex. Nut Turner from 8 to 10 will have La Plebe. And Techno for Science from 5 to 6 will have Termio. And that's what's happening this week, the holiday week, the last week of December at Pirate Cat Radio. Now here's Catherine with the final music of the year.
I have new music at Pirate Cat Radio. I'm your music director, Catherine. The first track I have for you is a very wintry Christmas track. This track is called Dissonance, and it's by Thorn One off their album So Far As Fast. For our next track, we're going to change up the tempo a little bit. This track is by The Struts. It's called Hey Baby, and it's off their new album, Boy Can't Dance. For the last band of the week, we are heading over to Malmö, Sweden. This band is called Frederick, and this track is called Nair. It's off their new album, Trilogy, out on Cora Records. If you'd like to find out more about the band, please head over to PirateCatRadio.com. We have album reviews of a lot of our featured artists that you hear here. And if you'd like to contribute your music, as always, you can email me at music@PirateCatRadio.com.